Today, some people coming in.
Okay. We didn't start yet, don't worry. We're just getting started. The page is on the table. It's the same page as last week, those who brought them. We're using the same page of last week. It's really became now de facto the third part of Psychological Insights of Torah Giants, where I just want to recap source number 10 on the bottom of the first side of the page that dealt with the issue of treifa, of meat that comes from an animal that was devoured in the field. Uvasara basadet treifa lo tochelu. The animal did not die of natural causes, and it's halachically applied to improper shechita. If the slaughtering was done improperly, then the behema is ruled as a treifa. Today we use the word treif in a colloquial manner, just meaning anything non-kosher, right? So that Jew is treif, right? You say everything is, this is not good, it's not that, you say treif. But treifa is a technical term, as opposed to nevela, which means a carcass of a dead animal. The animal died, so that's not a treifa, it's a nevela. It's also asur. And they have to define which avera are we actually talking about. The question that the Sefer HaChinuch, the author of Chinuch, uses, and he borrows an idea from both Rambam and Ramban, they both subscribe to this, that which is forbidden foods are, by definition, unhealthy foods. And the Kadosh Baruch Hu would never have allowed us to eat things that would be healthy. The Rambam says this with regard to pork meat. I remember in Rabbi Tendler's class in biology for poets, that was called biology for non-science majors, or as my wife would call it, biology for idiots. So in Rabbi Tendler's class, he would tell us about the trichinosis bacteria, that a person who does not eat pork meat has zero chance of getting that disease. That doesn't mean that's the reason why the Torah prohibited Besar Chazir. It just means that if the Torah prohibited Besar Chazir, maybe one day we're going to find out that it's unhealthy to eat it anyway. And that clashes with something that the Rambam writes in his medical writings. There is now a four-volume series called Pirkei Moshe, and it has to do with the Rambam's medical writings. He's written so much, and it's almost a digest of some of his writings. He served as the physician of the Sultan of then in Egypt, and he had to attend to the medical needs of the entire family. And there was a particular young fellow who obviously was living a wild life and also getting sick, so the Rambam was there to give him some prescription. Now, he wasn't there to prescribe drugs necessarily, although he did that too. He was more important to the Rambam was preventive medicine. And the Rambam was a holistic picture person. He believed that you can prevent many of the illnesses by proper diet, and he writes a lot about a diet. There, he gives this fellow in the palace of the Sultan a schedule of a diet, which includes the eating of pork meat. And that's very, very interesting, because if the Rambam felt that pork meat is dangerous, is unhealthy, let's call it unhealthy for human consumption, does that mean he wants to say that it's unhealthy for Jewish consumption, but if you happen to be not Jewish, it's okay? Or did the Rambam feel that this particular individual, while it would be worth the risk of whatever you might contract by eating pork meat, the benefits and the gains would outweigh the risk, and therefore he's prescribing to him to a measure of pork meat to eat. Without getting into the whole subject about Muslims not eating. Right, the Rambam knew Islam also, so we're talking about reform Muslims, right? They weren't so frum, right? So Rav Kapach, in his Moreh Nevuchim, does mention that in the Pirkei Moshe, the Rambam seems to contradict himself, but I'm sure it's not a contradiction at all. And the Rambam, if he'd be here, he'd be able to explain why he wrote that. I'm just, you know, suggesting a possibility of what actually did happen. But what's important here is the Sefer HaChinuch says, if the animal is slaughtered, but the animal was perfectly healthy a moment ago, and now you rule that it's a treifa, how unhealthy could the meat be already? I mean, the animal is just slaughtered now. So you want to say that treif meat, it sets in with time. I agree with you that that if the animal was a trefa because it had punctured internal organisms, that means the animal was sick. So an animal sick would also affect adversely the health of the meat of that animal. But if the animal was perfectly healthy, but it was ruled trefa because it was just slaughtered and was slaughtered improperly, you know, where's the danger? Where's the health danger? And this the Sefer Chinuch has to address. And I mentioned parenthetically at the end of this year that after the 1936 Nuremberg laws, when the Nazis, Yimach Shemam, who was so careful about humane animals laws, couldn't care less about human beings, but the animals had to be so they forbade slaughtering unless the animal was stunned with electric shock. And so it was Rav Weinberg, Rav Chil Yaakov Weinberg, the Sri Deish, who thought that if the Shechita was done just a moment after the electric stunning, the meat would still be kosher. All of the poskim of the world came down hard on him, and he retracted on that psak. The leader was Rav Chaim Oizer Guzensky from Vilna, who was known as the Achiezer. And I remember I have a distant relative who's a rabbi in Teaneck, and I'm not talking about my brother because he's not so distant, but I have another cousin in Teaneck, a Rabbi Howie Jachter, who's a distant cousin of mine, and he once asked the Rav, about speaking about the Sri Deish, Rabbi Chil Yaakov Weinberg, who was a notorious makel, lenient in halacha. The Rav said, I can agree with the theory of every lenient opinion of the Sri Deish, except for two. And one of them was the psak on the electric stunning. He says that's what we couldn't go along with. So the Sefer Chinuch wants to know if an animal, something was done with it a moment before it was a healthy animal, and now you're ruling that it's trefa, what's wrong with the meat? So the Sefer Chinuch basically says you'll have to agree that even if something takes a long time for something to show up in reality, but it always begins somewhere. So the beginning, even though it might be minuscule, but it's also something that's somewhat dangerous. And I gave the illustration that if you believe that smoking two packs a day of cigarettes is dangerous to your health, and not just dangerous, as they right now, it can kill and so on. So what about the first cigarette that somebody smoked in his lifetime? How dangerous is that? So the answer is, well, maybe it's not that dangerous, except that it leads to, and I use the illustration of a basketball game, the first baskets is 2 points, but it's going to end with, a score of 100 to 98, and so who cares about the first 2 points? But if you don't have the first 2 points, you're never going to get to 98 or to 100. So at the beginning also, this Sefer Chinuch, he doesn't use the basketball illustration, but he uses the illustration of the beginnings. Of course, the question was raised, why you don't make a Shechianu the first time you smoke a cigarette? The answer is because you don't make brachas in the bathroom. So this has to do with conditioning, has a lot to do with conditioning as well. We talked about in behavioral psychology, so conditioning is the name of the game, and habit forming, which sometimes releases you from your bechira chofshit, your free will. And the Rav Zichron of the Bracha took this to Parshat Va'era and Bo, the two parshiot that we read last week and this coming Shabbat, with regard to the free will of Paro. Because already in this week's parsha, and already since the sixth plague, it says Vayechazek Hashem et Lev Paro. God is going to harden the heart, which means deny Paro the ability to let to decide that Am Yisrael should leave. And then, of course, the question is, why is he punished? This is questioned by the Ramban and the Rambam. Why is he punished for something that he's no longer responsible? If Kadosh Baruch Hu kicks in this Vayechazek Hashem et Lev Paro, so how can you punish him for that? So there are some good answers that are provided by both Rambam and Ramban. One being that what the mandate that Paro was given was up until a certain level of to enslave Am Yisrael, but he went further, way beyond. So the punishment is on the way beyond. And then the other reasons given as well. But the fact that Paro gets himself into a mode of saying no, so what happens by the sixth and seventh and eighth plague, he can no longer say yes any longer, because he's formed the habit of saying no to Moshe, even though the people have suffered in the first, second, third, fourth, and fifth plague. But he got into the habit. And the Rav said an unbelievable thought, that in spite of the fact that you might think that a person who does an Aveira 100 times is a lot worse spiritually than a person who did the Aveira once or twice. He says that might be true on some level, but on another level, the more you do the Aveira, the less intense it really is in a spiritual level. And the reason is because you've now become a robot, or you've gone on automatic pilot. You're no longer making decisions. And a person who does not make a decision any longer is no longer held responsible, or at least it's partial responsibility. So the first time, the second time, is clearly full responsibility, but the third, fourth, fifth, and 100th time, and 1,000th time, you're just doing it by rote, by remote control, and you're not in control any longer with your actions. And this is something that Chazal, when they echoed it, and they said, Kol ha'over, somebody who does an aveira vishoneh, I believe I brought it on the page as well, Naset lo keheter, did I bring it? Yeah, the first source on top. We said this 2 weeks ago. Kivan she'avar adam avera v'shanabo, person does an avera and repeats it, hutralo, it becomes permissible. So the Gemara says, hutralo, becomes permissible. Salka datach, you mean to say that it became permissible? Ele'ema, but say, na'aset lo keter. It appears to you as if it's permissible. Because somehow the thrust of the prohibition has been lessened because of regularity. And it was the thought of the Kotzke Rebbe who said, why doesn't the Gemara say a third time? He says, the third time it's already a mitzvah. You know, and the second time it's only mutter. It's only permissible. Third time it's already a mitzvah. And people who are habitual ovrei averot do not think about themselves in terms of a self-perception that they're reshoyim. They don't think they do anything wrong. Yeah.
I think the first time that you didn't get struck by lightning,
right,
leads you to
Right. This the analogy that I gave to the end of Parshat Bishalach, that it says about Amalek, Asher Karcha Baderech. So we read in the Shirat Hayam that all the nations of the world, they heard all about Kriyat Yamsuf and they were quite frightened. Aznev halu alufei Edom, Elei Moab Yochazei Moraad, Namogu Kol Yoshvei Kenan. They were all frightened. And yet comes Amalek, and they show that, you know what, you can attack Am Yisrael from the rear. So it says, Asher karcha baderech, karf, meaning from the word cold, that's how Rashi interprets, and it gives the example of a boiling, sizzling hot bathtub, nobody wants to put their finger in, but the first guy who jumps in, psychologically cools it for everybody else. So that's what happened, the Amalekim cooled it for everybody else. It's not such a terrible thing. You can hit Am Yisrael and you can get away with it. Also, even if they didn't get away with it, you know, you can do it. They're not invincible. It's almost like the Egyptians in the Yom Kippur War. So, you know, it was a tough going the first 2-3 weeks of the war, as you know. And the Egyptians did take over a sliver of the Sinai Peninsula. And even though they lost it all at the end, that does make a bit of a difference. But in the psyche of the Arab world, you know, they really delivered a blow to the Israelis and so on. The year after, when the Egyptians in Cairo were celebrating their great victory of the Yom Kippur War, so a general told President Sadat, another victory like this and we're through. It's a... there's not something that we should be boasting about. But all right. So this was an idea that we saw in the idea of treifa. If you flip the side, if you flip the page, so here we get to another concept that I could have used hundreds and hundreds of examples in halacha, but I've just used one because it's popular and I think we can learn something from it. But it's the concept of lo plug that I have underlined, lo plug rabbanan. The word pei lamed gimel means divide, and that's in the Chumash itself, dor hapilaga, the generation that was divided. They were divided by language, ultimately. That's how God dealt with the dor hapilaga that attempted to build a tower and revolt against God. So the word peleg in modern Hebrew means a section of, or sectorial. It's not everybody, but it's only a certain grouping within. That's a peleg. Like ha-peleg ha-litai of Yadut HaTorah. So Yadut HaTorah is a religious party, but it's an umbrella organization of two parties, of Agudat Yisrael, which is the war Hasidic, and the litaim, the litvaks from Rav Shach's world, was the Degel HaTorah. So it's called the peleg ha-litai. And within the litaim, it splits even further. So you have the peleg of Rav Orbach, Shmuel Orbach, you know, the guys who make demonstrations and close the streets, and the others. So that's called Peleg. And the word Miflaga, in Hebrew, which means a political party, because it's different. Rav Kook Zatzal never liked to use the word miflaga, because he said the word suggests divisiveness. He liked the word achdut. But the Gemara uses the word peleg, palga nizka, which means chatzi nezek and baba kama, and it shows up often enough that's the word. Lo plug means let's not be divisive. So the example I gave last week, and this will be the kickoff, is with musical instruments. Chazal gave there is a gzerah, a restriction on Shabbat, not to play musical instruments. There's absolutely no halachic prohibition from the 39 basic malachot of Shabbat from playing a musical instrument. You're not doing any of those 39 malachot. But there are many instruments that before you start playing them, you have to tune them. Or even if during the playing of it, you have to tune it. Tuning an instrument is called correcting a vessel, an instrument. So that's called tikkun kli. That's part of the malacha called boneh, construction. So we know that in the 39 malachot, you have 39 principal malachot that then carry derivatives. So tikkun kli is a derivative of boneh, of construction. And being that it's a derivative of construction, Chazal will worry that if you play an instrument like a string instrument, but it's a violin or guitar, and you tune it, so it's the tuning that's the problem, not the playing of the instrument. So better not play the instrument at all, because you might come to tune it. Fine, this we all understand. But what about an instrument that does not require tuning? You pick up a wind instrument, so it's not relevant. So here Chachamim said, lo plug. It's called the no exception rule. No exception rule. Once the Chazal threw out the prohibition against musical instruments, so it's now lo plug. And now, taken to its extreme, many of the poskim went further and said, not only can you not play a musical instrument, but you're not allowed to dance to singing, because dancing will somehow is a step away from a musical instrument already. And the Rambam so believes. Most poskim are against this, by the way. But if you go to Yemenite hakafot, that's that of Rav Kapach persuasion, where they follow the Rambam to the T, so there's no dancing on Simchat Torah because it's Yom Tov. And the Rambam says no dancing on Shabbat and Yom Tov because of the Gzeira. Right, I kind of like those kind of hakafos. It's made for my family, you know. But, of course, we had somebody in Ramot who came from the Breuers community in Washington Heights, and she described to me what hakafot was there. And there they said they all lined up in a perfect 360-degree circle. They all took one step in unison, and the gabbai said, Ad kan hakofa aleph. That was the first hakofa. So I think they were also in line with the Rambam's thinking. Not too much, not too much dancing there. But that was for different reasons. And some poskim say that you shouldn't clap on Shabbat with a beat, because a drum is an instrument that does not require tuning, but you can't play a drum on Shabbat because there's a gzeira against instruments. So once the drum is out, so maybe just clapping to keep a beat or banging on the table during Zmirot. So there are poskim who are against this, by the way.
How come you can sing?
Right, you can sing, and because that they didn't want to make a gzeira about, okay? That's too far. But there is an intermediary thing. I know some of you you enjoy chazanut, and the rest of you hate it because there's no in between. I discovered nobody's neutral on the question of chazanut. The Rav Zichron and the Rocha used to say, "I like chazanut very, very much, but not in shul." on a record and a concert, fine, fine. But shul is for davening. That's what he used to say. But the question of chazanut came up. Those who are familiar with the very, very big-time chazanim, they all use the tuning fork. A tuning fork gives you an A. And if you're musically inclined, from an A you can get to a C and to an E just in your head. That's not an issue. So if you know that a particular cantorial piece starts on a C, all I need is the A, and I got it. It's not a problem. But the question, there was some rabbanim who frowned upon using a tuning fork on Shabbat, because that's also an instrument that gives off music. Doesn't need to be tuned, but what's the difference? Lo plug, no exception rule. So it was the author of the Orach HaShulchan, Rav Chil Mechel Alevi Epstein, of the late 19th century, who was the great Malameit Zchut. I mean, he was the great defender of Am Yisrael. When he saw something that people were yelling, and he knew that you couldn't stop it. Sometimes you can come out with whatever prohibition you want, but the Chazonim are still going to use it. So now what you have to do is to show that it's not the worst thing in the world, and it's halakhically tenable to use a tuning fork on Shabbat. So he basically says that the tuning fork is not an instrument for the purpose of the music that comes out of it. It's an instrument for purpose of the singing. And the singing is mutar. And if the singing is mutar, permissible, therefore the use of the tuning fork is not prohibited. He didn't say it was a mitzvah to use it. He said it's not prohibited, even midrabanan, to use it. That was a real limud zchut for many of the chazanim who use a tuning fork. We had a gentleman in our shul who was a fine bat tefillah, he didn't use a tuning fork, but he had a watch, a wristwatch, that gave a certain hum to it, and he knew the key of the hum. So before he would start something, he'd always go like this, you know, like... So he wasn't worried to see if his watch was still ticking or not. How much time does he have for the piece? He was trying to get the proper note so he can start on the proper note and so on. So this is an example of low plug, where the question is, how far can you get? By the way, this is why whistling on Shabbat is permissible, because whistling is not an instrument. You whistle with your mouth, you know, and it's like singing. It's another version of singing, so that would be permissible on Shabbat. So, you know, those people who feel that banging on the table with a beat, specifically with a beat, as if you're mimicking drumming or you know, sometimes... So it's nice, it embellishes the zmirot, but there are some poskim who frown upon that and say that it's... yeah.
Right, so I just got a question. So where does shofar fall in? Is that an instrument, not an instrument?
Shofar. Okay, so where does shofar fall into this? And shofar always comes out on Yom Tov, right? It always comes out on Yom Tov, whether you like it or not, right? So, and the reason why we don't blow shofar on Shabbat has absolutely nothing to do with this discussion. Absolutely not. Nothing at all. So the Gemara tells us that the blowing of a shofar is chokhmah ve'eina malacha. It's a talent. That doesn't mean a wisdom. It means it's a talent, and it's not a malacha. And because it's a mitzvah, so the mitzvah overrides all these considerations. Furthermore, in the Beit HaMikdash area, and in some, according to some opinions, all of Yerushalayim, but that's not Yerushalayim of near Barkat, the municipality. It's Yerushalayim that was sanctified by the Kedusha, the sanctification of Yerushalayim, which, by the way, we have a fairly good idea where it is. It runs partially through the Old City. You take a good tour of the Old City with somebody who knows the lines. The Kotel area is part of it, of where Yerushalayim was, and most of Ir David is part of the old Yerushalayim. Beit HaMikdash was like the most northern border of Yerushalayim, and it didn't go very west either. Even Yamin Moshe, and this area was just mountainous area, was not settled, not populated in the days of Beit HaMikdash. But there are those who say that in the area of Yerushalayim, and certainly in the area of the Har HaBayit and the Chatzer, the yard of Beit HaMikdash, the rabbinic restrictions did not apply. And the reason is because the Beit Din HaGadol, the Sanhedrin, sat in session over there, and that wasn't a judiciary. They were the 70 religious Torah leaders of the generation. So it's almost to say they had mashgichim there. So nothing would go wrong. Everything would be 100%. And people were very careful about the detail of the halachic definition on a biblical level. So there was no need in the Beit HaMikdash area for any of the rabbinic restrictions. And that's why in the Beit HaMikdash, they were allowed to, you have the instruments with accompany the Leviim for the singing, for the Shir Shah Leviim, Ayu Omrim B'Beit HaMikdash. And other things went on in Beit HaMikdash that would be prohibited to us because of all kinds of gzerot, all kinds of rabbinic restrictions. But at Beit HaMikdash, they didn't. So shofar is a mitzvah that, believe it or not, emanates from Beit HaMikdash. Even though we do it in the shul, we do it at home, but it emanates from Beit HaMikdash. And how do we know that? All the mitzvot of the Chagim are found in Parshat Emor, by Yikra Kav Gimel. So there we read about the matzah, and we read about matzah also in this week's parasha, but you get a summary of the mitzvot, and you get Svirat HaOmer there, and you get Sukkot there, and Arba Minim there. It's all, and the fasting of Yom Kippur is there. But Rosh Hashanah, there it says Zichron Tru'a Mikra Kodesh. The operative pasuk of Tkiyat Shofar Rosh Hashanah is Parshat Pinchas, which is the korban, the sacrifice of the day. And that's where it says Yom Teruah Yelachem. And there was even some of the Rishonim who believed that the biblical mitzvah of shofar is only in Beit HaMikdash, and that we blow shofar outside Beit HaMikdash is what's called Halacha LeMoshe MiSinai. It's an oral tradition that we also blow. Most are against this. The Rambam doesn't buy what I just said now. The Rambam believes that the Shofar Mitzvah is a mitzvah, which is a biblical mitzvah in the Chumash for everybody, for all times. But there are some of the Rishonim, Rabbi Zrachya HaLevi from Provence and others, who believed that the fact that the mitzvah is not given in its natural habitat in Parshat Emor, but rather in Parshat Pinchas, which is a Korban story, so it's really linked to Beit HaMikdash. And as a mitzvah linked to Beit HaMikdash, so the gzeira of tikkun kli, which doesn't apply to a shofar anyway, so it's just a low plug that we would prohibit it. So that's obviously waived because it's a biblical mitzvah, and that's why we blow it on Rosh Hashanah. And yeah, Baksha.
I've never asked a rub this, but clapping of hands.
Yeah. Right, so some people do it with a shinui. Some people do it with a shinui. And shinui means doing it differently. Like if you want to clap, so that you know to clap with the back of the hand instead of the normal way that's doing it, right? I think the best way to clap on Shabbat is to do this. Right? Then you don't run into any problems. Right? You don't interfere with anybody or make any noise. So that's all. You're right. The question comes up, let's say, applauding. Let's assume you're sitting in a Oneg Shabbat, and somebody gets up and says a Dvar Torah, and the natural response, you heard something nice, as you might do in the weekday, you might applaud. So again, this is not an applaud, which is clapping of hands for purposes of keeping a beat with music, but it's a completely different clapping of hands. So there's more of a tendency to leniency for that kind of clapping of hands, because it's really not even covered at all in the context of the gzeira of musical instruments, as opposed to with singing. So it's like playing the role of the drum. So there you can already begin to see why some of the machmirim, those who are strict, might think that this would be prohibited. Okay. So what's the issue of the lo plug that Yechaveda? Who's the Yechaveda? It's Rav Avadi Yosef, Zichrono Levracha. It's the second series of his Shelot to Tshuvot. The first was called Yabia Omer, and then the second was the more up-to-date, was Yechaveda. And he's dealing with the question of candle lightings for Friday night and for Yom Tov night. What comes first, the bracha or the lighting of the candle? Both on Shabbat and on Yom Tov. So I think we'll start with the end game of Ashkenazi practice. And I'd be interested to hear if anybody here does it otherwise. But in most Ashkenazi circles, the woman will light the candles and then make the bracha. You know, make the hands and everything, and then make the bracha. And a Yom Tov do it the other way around. We'll make the bracha and then light the candles. Does anybody do it differently than what I just said now?
I do it simultaneously on Yom Tov.
Simultaneously.
I'm lighting, I say
the. Because you want to yaitze all the shitas. You don't know.
I don't know where I got it from.
You don't know where you got it from.
So if it's wrong, I'll change.
Right, do you cover your eyes on Yom Tov?
No.
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 Okay.
No.
What's the question about Yom Tov?
The bracha comes before the lighting of the candle.
Not by me.
So what do you do? You do like on Shabbat.
And then I say, if it has to be Shechi, on the way, say whatever bracha.
In other words, you do for Shabbat Yom Tov exactly the way you do for Shabbat.
Yes.
Okay.
Except you look.
Except what?
You look at the candles.
Except you look at the candles. Okay. Okay, so this kind of question, which is a trick question, you're all right. It depends who you asked. Right? Because there's really a tremendous dispute on this. And Rav Avadi Yosef takes the opinion, and this becomes very, very accepted in the Sfaradi home today, because he had tremendous impact on the Sfaradi home, and that is, you always make the bracha first and then the lighting afterwards, even Friday night, which is obviously not the way most Ashkenazim do it. And the reason is, he says, the bracha always precedes the mitzvah act. That's called over la'asiyatan. That's what's supposed to be done. So why shouldn't it be done for Shabbos candles? But he is aware of the fact that Ashkenazim do it the other way around, and not just a few handful Ashkenazim, but the Ramoshe Yisraelis so brings it in the Shulchan Aruch, and the rationale is that the fear on Friday night is that a woman might erroneously think that by saying the bracha v'tzivanu ladik ner Shabbat, she's already accepted upon herself the sanctity of Shabbat. Then she can't light the candles anymore because it's Shabbos already. So you have to do it the other way around. You have to do the lighting and then the bracha. So if you do that, you don't have the bracha before the act. Okay.
We do the bracha.
We have some examples of that. That the bracha, the mitzvah is done before the bracha. What?
For a lot of things before you eat the apple.
No, there you make the bracha before you eat.
You make the bracha.
But when do you have the mitzvah before the bracha? When do you have the mitzvah before the bracha? Class A example is netilat yadayim. When you wash for bread, you make the bracha netilat yadayim and then wash? No. You wash and then do al netilat yadayim. Why? The reason is because if the reason we're washing is because perhaps there's some tumah, some spiritual defilement on any level on the fingers, you want to say the bracha b'tahara when you've already gone through the process. So it's got to be, the bracha can only be after the act, after you've done the netilat yadayim. Now some poskim to point out, we have a gimmick. We can actually still catch the last moment of the before. How can you catch the last moment before if you already did the netilat yadayim? Because the Rambam says that drying your hands is part of washing your hands. So if you wash your hands, netilat yadayim, for bread, and then say the bracha, and then go and dry your hands, which most people do, so the bracha was said before the completion of the netilat yadayim. If the drying of the hands is like the completion of the act has two parts, the washing and the drying. And the bracha is made in between. So you got something there. And how about a woman saying a bracha at mikveh? When does she say the bracha? Before she does the mikveh or after? After. So there's a minag, every balanit knows that, to tell the woman to take a dunk a second time after the bracha. Why is that? For the same reason. That the real tefillah is the second tefillah. The first one was just that she should be able to say the bracha b'tahara. And then she gets in before. So why did they do that? Why did they just make the bracha beforehand? The answer is because a ger or gioret who has to go to the mikveh has to say a bracha asher kitshanu b'mitzvotav v'tzivanu ala tvila. And the ger or gioret cannot, the convert, cannot make that bracha before the mikveh because he or she is not Jewish yet. So the bracha can only be made after the immersion from the mikveh. And whereas the mikveh, the scenario of giyur is an important place where tevilah takes place, Chachamim said, lo plug, no exceptions. Even those people who could have said the bracha before the tevilah will say it after. So we now have a uniform mode of how people do a mikveh, a tevilah and a mikveh, and a bracha. It's the tevilah and then the bracha. So you may say, one second, but a normal person who's not for giyoret, it could be the other way around. Right, but lo plug. No exception rule kicks in. And we do it for everybody the same way. In a similar vein, the nusach of the bracha, there are two different versions of bracha that are made for any type of mitzvah. They all start with Asher Kidshanu b'mitzvotav v'tzivanu. Some of them carry the word al, over, or concerning the following, al netilat yadayim, al achilat matzah, or something like that. And some of them do not have the word al, but they just have a lamed, lehadlik ner, and so on, lehadlik ner shel Shabbat, lehadlik ner shel Chanukah, and some have al netilat lulav, lishmoa kol shofar. So, is it arbitrary? Or is there something to this? Why did Chachamim say al for some of the brachot and a lamed li to do something on other brachot? So in Masechet Pesachim, Dav Zayin, there's a whole page analyzing this with different opinions of what the criteria might be for those brachot that are category 1 and those brachot that are category 2. The problem is that all of those who suggested criteria, and it spills over to the Middle Ages, to the Rishonim, the Tosfot, the Rambam, everybody comes up with criteria. They all have exceptions to the rules, to their rules that they figured out. They all figured out rules, And then, but there's an exception here, an exception there. There's so many exceptions to the rule that there's a view in Tosfot that's that like one of the Balei HaTosfot just throws his hands up in the air and says there are no rules, right? It's a balagan. There's no rules. They just couldn't live with the fact that there was just so many sets of rules, and each set of rules brought upon so many different exceptions to the rule. So where's the rule if everything's governed by the exceptions to the rule? Fine. So one of the things that the Rambam says is that if the mitzvah is done if the bracha is said immediately before the mitzvah is performed, literally over la'asiyatan, then it's vitzivanu le la'asot. So the Rambam says that if you're going to take the lulav, he says the bracha is vitzivanu litol lulav. But if you happen to have the lulav in your hand already, which means in essence you fulfilled the mitzvah, but you didn't say the bracha, so then it's al netilat lulav. And the question is, why did the minag ultimately become al netilat lulav? But the reason why it's al netilat yadayim, the Rambam says, is because the mitzvah is done before the bracha. So you can only say li tol yadayim if you're now going to wash your hands. But if you'd washed your hands already and now you're going to say the bracha, you cannot say li tol yadayim. So the bracha is al netilat yadayim. And the reason why on lulav, indeed, it's al netilat lulav, because you have to hold the arba minim in your hand before you say the bracha. But if you've done that, the Gemara says, you already fulfilled the mitzvah. So you're always post facto, you're always after the act. So the bracha is al netilat lulav, as opposed to shayfer, lishmoa kol shofar, or lihadlik ner shul chanukah. When do we make the bracha? Before we light the Hanukkah candles. And here's the catch, when Shabbos candles, lihadlik ner shul Shabbat. So in theory, the Shabbos candles should be, the bracha should be said before the candle lighting takes place. And only after the days of the Gemara did this fear kick in that certain women would think erroneously that they've accepted Shabbat already, and that had to be addressed. Yeah.
When you put on tefillin, you say Asher
Kishem Lehaniah. Right.
And then you say Al Mitzvahs.
Correct. The reason is, that's a very good point, is of Lehaniah tefillin is because you say the bracha immediately before you make the tie,
right,
before you tie the kesher. Yeah. So it's Lehaniah tefillin. That's correct. The second bracha on tefillin, the Sfardim don't have it all, by the way. They don't have it all. And Ashkenazim, it's the Rambam's view, and the Ashkenazim have a second bracha, which is unclear at what point you actually do say the second bracha. And the Rambam's of the opinion that the second bracha is not for the putting on the tefillin shel rosh, but by being crowned with the tefillin shel rosh all day. So it's an ongoing mitzvah. And that's why it's al mitzvah tefillin, and not, you know, something like with a lamet. That's why it's such. So with regard to Nerot Shabbat and Yom Tov, Rav Avad Yosef is a stickler, and he says it's always the bracha before, whether it's Shabbat, whether it's Yom Tov. But he's aware that Ashkenazim do it differently. But there were some who believe, some Ashkenazi poskim who believe, that if women are accustomed to light and then make the bracha for Shabbat, they should do it the same way for Yom Tov because of lo plug. No exceptions. You're right that on Yom Tov you certainly can do it the other way, because on Yom Tov you're allowed to take a match and light a candle. That's not an issue. But because there's many more opportunities of Adlakat Nerot on Shabbat than in any Yom Tov during the year, so lo plug, lo plug. And here, let the habit kick in. This is the way we're going to do it. And if we start doing it otherwise, certain women might get a little bit mixed up as to how to do it. They may erroneously practice this on a Shabbat, which can create a problem. But take a look what's fascinating in this tshuva. In source number 11 on top. Ulefi ze, it's dot, 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 because he's written a lot before. Ein kol hevdel bein hadlakat neher shel Shabbat o shel Yom Tov. Rav Yosef takes the position, when you light Shabbos candles, Yom Tov candles, it's the same thing. Shela olam tzarich levarech tchila v'chakach ladlik. First you have to make the bracha and then light the candles. Ulam, however. Then he starts quoting. Gam lefi ma shekatav b'shelot u'tshuvot maharai. This is, I believe, one of the Chachmei Ashkenaz of the late 14th century. Shemiktzat nashim. This is interesting. Some women, nohagot, practice ladlik nerot Shabbat, porsot yedehem keneged hanerot, and then spread their fingers, their hands, in front of their eyes, in front of, basically covering up the candles. They're covering their eyes, but they're really covering their eyes from seeing the candles. Umevorchot, and then they say the bracha. Kedei sheyechashev, it should be considered keover lasiyatan. V'lo ratzu levarech kodem adlaka, and they don't want to say the bracha before the active candle. Sheimkein kvar kiblu Shabbat. They might think that they accepted Shabbat already with the bracha. Einan rishaot yoter lahadlik. They would not be able to light any longer because it would be already Shabbat in their minds. Many years ago, when I discussed certain things of minhag, I quoted a professor Toshma, Olav Shalom, from the Hebrew University, who wrote phenomenal work about the development of minhag, and he says that although this reason is the classic reason given in halacha why women took upon themselves to cover their eyes and they lit the candles, now they're covered, they're not looking, and they say the bracha. And now they're supposed to light the candles, and they all of a sudden they see, poof, the candles are lit. Look at that, you know, happened automatically. And they, as a gesture of Over LaSiatan. So Professor Toshma actually proves that something else was the origin of this minhag. And he goes back to many, really to almost to the days of Chazal, to show that women at the time of Hadlakat Nerot Shabbat did two things of great importance. One was they gave tzedakah. And it's not an accident that a tzedakah box was associated with Nerot Shabbat. Until this very day, there's still women who practice this. We'll put something in a J&F pushka. You know, for years, people had a J&F pushka. They put something in. And I pointed out in the certain matzevot in Poland, the death of a woman, they bake a matzeva, and you'd have two Nerot Shabbat where one ner is broken, which symbolized the woman has fallen. And next to it would be a kupat tzedakah. It was something that was very, very common. Now, once that was the case, why was the tzedakah associated with Ner Shabbat? Because of another minhag, a most probably more important minhag. And that was that a woman sensed that this was a moment that she could communicate and connect to Kadosh Baruch Hu on a very intimate level. And she wanted to say a tefillah for her family, for the well-being of everybody in her surroundings, became a very, very private tefillah. And tefillah carries two things. One, the gesture of tefillah, as we see in the Parshiot HaShavua of Moshe Rabbeinu, Efros et Kapai. This is a gesture of tefillah, spreading the hands. And women would put their hands up in tefillah. You know, and they would say in Yiddish, in Europe, you know, all kinds of things. You know, we need this, we need that, and so on. This became the origin of the hands at the time. And the tzedakah was associated with this, because the Gemara says that if somebody says, makes a claim, Ha'omer Sela Zul Tzedakah. It's found in Masechet Pesachim Davchet. If somebody says, Ha'omer Sela Zul. Sela means it's a coin. It's a coin in days of Chazal. This coin will go to tzedakah. On condition, almanat, sheyichye b'ni, person's son is very sick, critically sick, and is giving tzedakah, and he says, I will give tzedakah, provided my son survives, hareze tzadik amur. That is a legitimate type of condition, where normally you're not allowed to condition for performance of mitzvah with a Kadosh Baruch Hu about anything. You can't say, I need something badly from you, so I'll be more careful about Shabbat, I'll be more careful about Kashrut. You're not allowed to do that. That's called bribery. Only politicians are allowed to bribe. But to God, you can't. Doesn't work. Asher lo yikach shochad, it says in Dvarim. And Ramban says, zu shochad shel mitzvah. You can't bribe God with mitzvot. But there's one exception. The Kadosh Baruch Hu allows himself to be bribed with tzedakah. Allows himself. That's why in a Mishaber Fachoyle, there's usually a donation that's associated. Whether it's spelled out or not spelled out, but it's in the text. Sheyiten tzedakah. And the reason is because this is the a halachically approved type of gesture that you're allowed to ask Kadosh Baruch Hu to heal someone, and if it works out, you will give tzedakah. What the poskim then kick around is, and if a person doesn't survive, you still owe the tzedakah as a neder, or was the neder conditional on sheyichye b'ni or not? That's a halachic discussion. Yeah.
Same concept with Kelmale.
Kelmale.
And you say you can give tzedakah?
So they are exactly what's the condition? That you want to know that the neshama goes to Gan Eden or not? That you're not going to know what? Askarat nishmato. What exactly that means? It means it's an opportunity to show that the nifter had a son, a daughter who's practicing good deeds on this world, and that would act as a merit, be meritorious for the neshama. That's all it is. Oh, kiddush, that you might be in a regular mishaberach. I'm talking about mishaberach for a chayla. You don't give a kiddush because of mishaberach for a chayla. What?
Rabbi, couldn't use the same concept whenever you give tzedakah in memory on a yort side.
Right.
Any concept.
Like right. So that is that kind of tzedakah is that it's meritorious that the neshama can always claim, look, I wasn't such a bad guy. Take a look, I left over family that gives tzedakah. That's all it is. It's nice. It's very important. Some shuls, they announce the sums. The Rav actually felt that it is even proper, it's proper to announce, to give it. The Gabbai doesn't have to yell it out, but that you should specify a sum, because let's assume you say, Bavushi Tenstaka, and the Gabbai in his mind says $20,000, so maybe it might obligate. So you just better clear it with him that you plan to give 20 shekel and not $20,000. So that might be a better deal. The Rav didn't say the Gabbai has to announce it publicly, but to some shuls, would that become the public pressure of how much you're giving is an indication of why the Gabbai gave you an aliyah in the first place,
yeah.
Because it's a fundraising gimmick. So I remember I heard from Rabbi Joseph Lukstein, Zichron Levracha, the great father of Rabbi Chatzkel from the KJ, Kilat Yeshurun in New York City. So after being rabbi for 50 years, he did what most of his congregants did. He went down to became a snowbird in Florida. He went to Miami. He becomes a balabas after 50 years being a rav. Becomes a balabas in a shul. She said he paid membership and everything. So that's when the gabbaim start snuffing around the snowbirds from New York. That it's big bucks for the shul. So some guy who the gabbai thought was going to really, really give something substantial. So they give him an aliyah. The gabbai says bavushi yitain, and he's waiting to hear some nice amount. The guy holds two fingers. He goes shnei. He's going to give $2. Shnei, he says. Shnei in Hebrew is shnei.
Snow.
So the Gabbai says in Yiddish, is nitok and shnei in Miami. Shnei is snow. It doesn't snow in Miami. We don't take $2 donations. Is nitok and shnei in Miami. Well, it's wrong. Did you read the paper? To last week, there was shnei in Miami.
There was?
Yeah, I told this to my son.
Oh, wow.
He came back from Miami. He said he missed the snow. He said, I mean, don't think it was a blizzard, Yeah, yeah. No, it didn't hit Miami. It hit northern Florida. It hit northern Florida. That's good enough. That's close enough. Yeah, Bakshan.
Are you saying that people should change their menhag as a result of
No. You keep doing what your Elta Bubba did.
Good.
I didn't tell anybody to change anything. Just trying to explain. But I want to get to something exciting that Rav Vadi Yosef says. He quotes then in the fourth line, V'chein pasak ha-ramah, Rav Moshe Yisrael, in the Orachayim and Shulchan Aruch, V'chein nagu yotzei Ashkenaz. This is the way Ashkenazi women practice. Mikol makom, nevertheless, tamze eino shayachav legave yomtov. This reason is inapplicable for a regular yomtov. Sharei mutar ladlik b'yomtov. You're allowed to light candles on yomtov. V'lechein sarich levarech v'akakach ladlik. That's why you have to make the bracha on before yomtov candles and then light the candles. Kedin kol ha-mitzvot shemavorchin alehem, shemorech alehem over la-siyatan, like any other mitzvah. And then he starts quoting the following. Lechein pasak harav yuspa b'no shel ha-prisha. Who is the prisha? Prisha, if you buy before the Shulchan Aruch, the forerunner of Shulchan Aruch was the Tur, and that's Rabbi Yaakov ben Asher, the son of the Rosh. So on the small print, there is a Drisha and a Prisha, and it's like secondary commentaries on this. And the author of the Prisha quotes B'shem Imo Harabanit, quotes his mother, a distinguished Rebbetzin, L'chalek b'minhagan, to divide in the custom between Birkat Neirot Shabbat and Birkat Neirot Yom Tov. That for Shabbat you do it one way, and for Yom Tov the other way. Avopin, even though Shahamagen Avraham, one of the great poskim Shulchan Aruch, wrote that Ein Chochma Leisha. Oy. Right? Yeah. Delo palug rabbanan bein Shabbat liyomtov. The Magen Avraham was of the opinion, no, I'm not interested in hearing, you know, what a Rebbetzin had to say, but there's no low plug here. Don't get into differences. We're going to start getting messed up. Mikol makom, nevertheless, says Rav Avadya, kivar iskimu achronim, the late poskim, agreed ledivrei harabanit shehi isha asher nasa liba b'chokma. This Rebbetzin, she was a Talmud Chacham. She was a Talmud Chacham, and you can... Right. And the truth is, on this very, very issue, when the Rav Zichron Lebracha used to quote his father and his Zayda, he would always say, you know, I heard from my father in the name of my grandfather, but in Yiddish it sounds better, Chol Gehelt from Fata and Noman from Zayda. On this, he once said, Chol Gehelt from Mama and Noman from Baba. He heard from his Baba the same thing, that on Yom Tov, you light, you bake the Bracha first, and then you light. So this is a usage of loyplug. So loyplug means, you know, the no exception rule. And this brings us to source number 12. And it brings us to the question of crossing on a red light when you know on Friday night there's not hardly any traffic. Now that presupposes that you're careful during the normal weekday, which is not always a given. Not always a given. And how does that happen? Because kids see adults cross on the red light. And that teaches them that you can cross on the red light. Whether their own parents cross on the red light or not, maybe they do, maybe they don't, but the outside influences very much impact, especially if you have to catch a bus, you know, and so on, and you're what's called mora heter. You all of a sudden give yourself the license that to violate or to break the rules. Once the rules have been broken, you're selling yourself down completely in terms of moral behavior. There's a pasuk in Mishlei Perek Aleph. Kein orchot kol botzea batza et nefesh be'alav yikach. What does the word betza mean? Bet tzadik ayin in the Chumash. Sone betza, ma betza ki naroget achinu v'chisino adamo. No. Betza means money. When Yehuda said, well, you want to kill Yosef? We can make a few bucks on this, right? We're not going to earn anything. You know, you can pick up a quick money. Let's sell him. At least, you know, we'll get rid of him. We agree to get rid of Yosef. We'll make something on the deal. You know, ma betza kinaroget achinu. Sone betza is a term that Yitro tells Moshe Rabbeinu for judges. They should be those who hate graft. So betza really means money that was earned in a crooked manner. Any type of money that's earned in a crooked manner is called in Tanakh betza. So Shlomo HaMelech says, Kein orchot, orchot from the word orach hayim. If this is the way you live your life, kol botzea batza, that the way you earn your money is by crooked means, et nefesh be'alav yukach, you're only one step away from murder. Because you're ultimately going to justify everything. You're going to justify covering your own tracks that because some guy knows you did something, and you're going to, you know, call the Italian mafia and put out a contract on him, and to that. I thought it
because
would be nice.
Because you made the bracha.
Right. Shkaya. I thought it was nice. I thought it was very romantic.
Yes.
Very intimate and romantic, you know. They just ruined the shter de simcha. All right. So the problem is, and this is what Shlomo HaMelech was saying, you get used to a certain mode of behavior and you can't really get out of it. You get deeper and deeper and deeper into it. You know, so one person says, yeah, I'm always careful about not crossing on the red light, but on a Friday night it's a major intersection, but there's no traffic, so what do you want? You know, so you cross. That's how it starts, because you justified that kind of crossing. And the next time, it's the end, middle of the weekday, you looked right, you looked left, and there was no traffic, and you went. And the next time, you looked right, you looked left, there's a car, but he's far away. You went. And next time, he's not that far away, and you also went. And before you know it, you get hit. You get hit. Why? Because, what happened? Because you conditioned yourself that the red light doesn't mean anything to you. Doesn't mean anything anymore. Doesn't mean wait until there's a green light. And that kind of conditioning is something that the halakha very much takes into consideration. So if you look at source number 12, where I snuff out this idea, is the Gemara in Masechet Brachot, the sixth chapter. It says, "Omer Rab Chanina Bar Papa, Kol Hanehene Min Olam Hazeh Belo Bracha Ki Ilu Gozel LaKadosh Baruch Hu UKnesset Yisrael." Whoever derives benefit from this world without saying a bracha, literally on food, Shakolni Bilbaro, Motzi Lech Min Haaretz, on fragrance, Hanoten Reach Tov LaPeirot, you're deriving benefit from this world. Is you're a thief. You're stealing something from God, and you're stealing something from Klal Yisrael. Shenemar, as it says, Gozel Aviv Imo, and it says, Ve'omer Ein Pesha Chever Hu Le'ish Mashchit. You are a companion to the destructive person. Who's the destructive person? So it says, Ein Aviv El HaKadosh Baruch Hu, as it says, Halo Avicha Kanecha, Ein Imo El Knesset Yisrael, as it says, Shema Bini Musar Avicha Balti Tosh Torat Imecha. And who is the Ish Mashchit? The Gemara says, "Chaver hu liYeravam benevat sheishchit et Yisrael laviem shebeshamayim." Who was Yeravam benevat? He was the first king of the divided kingdom after Shlomo Melech, when the kingdom divided to the Yehuda, which was the southern kingdom, and his son Rechavam becomes Melech Yehuda, and Yeravam benevat from Shebet Ephraim becomes the Melech of the northern kingdom. So, what was so terrible at Yeravam benevat? He actually was appointed by a navi. He saw that in the midst of Hakel, where everybody's supposed to come to Beit Mikdash once in 7 years on Chag HaSukkot, it was either the year of Shemitah or the year after Shemitah, that's a machloket, but once in 7 years. And the Melech reads sections from Sefer Dvarim. All right, you know, will the real Melech please stand up? Who's the Melech? Is it Yerachavam or is it Yeravam? And the Melech has a right to sit on a chair in the Chatzar Beit Mikdash. Are they going to have two chairs for the Melech B'Israel? It's only a question of time, where the people are going to see Yeravam as an imposter. He's not a real king. He's second fiddle, nothing more than that. So he seals the borders and does not allow the Ten Shvatim to come to Yerushalayim. But because they need spirit, you know, sacrificial activity, he sets up two regional Batei Mikdash, one in the southern point of his kingdom, which is north of Yerushalayim in Bet El, and the other one is the very north in the Galil Elyon, the Dan area. So the Dan, with the Dan and the Banyas, that's where there was a Mikdash of Yeravam Menevat, and Bet El had a Mikdash of Yeravam Menevat, and that's it, no longer Yerushalayim. So even though there were people who wanted to go to Yerushalayim, he forced them that they could not go. And they felt this need to continue Avodat Hashem. By them, Avodat Hashem, service of God, meant sacrificial activity. So he has these regional shtiblach in Eretz Yisrael. So he's a choyte umachti et arabim. He not only sins, but he forces others to sin as well. This is what happens when you do something like cross on the red light and somebody's standing next to you, like somebody young, and sees that it's okay to cross. You become a chote umachti et arabim. And this has to be understood, the responsibility. So while you don't see, God forbid, what might happen to this kid 10 years down the road because of the education that you gave him, but you are going to be held responsible if that happens, if the kid learned from you, or an adult learned from you, that kind of behavior. If you see, if you show that that you can get away with things, and you know, my examples now, and I, my wife tells me I should just, you know, just drop it already, but I because we share a car, so many times I use the buses, and when I go on the long Langeloksen buses, so I like to sit in the back where you have the buses that you can get on the third and fourth door, and just take note how many people just get on the bus and forget to put their cards there. Forget. So that they forget. They ganovim, one after the other. Ganovim. Now how could this be? Because they got away with it once. They got away the second time. And I sometimes talk to some of them, especially before Yom Kippur. I got a mouthful in return that it's a Zenena v'zelo chaser. Zenena v'zelo chaser is halacha that says he's gaining benefit, but he's not losing. The bus driver is going to drive whether I'm on the bus or not. So it's not Geneva. I said, you know, this is what's called Naval Bashut HaTorah, according to the Ramban. Now, how can you say this for Yom Kippur? My gosh. The usual answer is, Matoved Eged. You know, like, you work for Eged. Like, who? I said, no, I work for God. It says, Ocheach Tochiach Adamideva. You see, the problem is, the halacha is, Ocheach Tochiach, you're supposed to give admonition if there's a fighting chance the person's going to listen to you. If he doesn't, if you're not going to listen, it's best not to say anything. And unfortunately, statistical probability is not going to listen to you anyway. But it's a terrible, terrible chil. It's a chil Hashem of the greatest magnitude.
I think more common are people in the supermarket taking an apple or whatever and eating it.
Yeah, so that's Geneva also.
Alamakol.
That's Geneva. That's Geneva. Or even tasting some, tasting a grape. You know? So there are stores that, if you would ask the manager, they would be moichel. So that there's a mechila that kicks in. If a manager would say, you ask him point blank, if I just took one grape just to taste what it is, the texture, would that be okay? In all likelihood, a manager would say, you know, fine.
You
know.
A lot of times they offer you. Case, you know,
something offer, else. Something offer. Else. Something else. There, you can maybe have a whole lunch by going into, by having them offer you things.
People take the agalot from the supermarket and keep it in the
That's
yards.
Geneva. Geneva, Mamish Geneva. Mamish Geneva. Mamish Geneva.
Yeah. I once saw a Dry Bones cartoon. A Dry Bones cartoon. Traffic lights. Green, go. Yellow, go faster. Red, be very careful, go.
Yeah, never. Okay, so we talked about certain behavioral patterns, and just ran out of time now, but next week, I get those of you know I'm going to be in Eilat, so you're invited to hear the shiur at 5 o'clock in the evening on Wednesday, but Phil Chernofsky will give a shiur, so there will be a shiur at this time. The last two, I don't know if we'll get to it, maybe we'll do something else, but it had to do with tshuva, which is mood swings. Mood swings is also a behavioral issue, and embarrassment. I mean, Jewish people have made a premium about guilt.
No.
Guilt. The guilt trip, you know? And all of tshuva is predicated on mood swings and guilt feelings and so on, which really cuts into behavioralists, psychologists who believe they can always predict with accuracy how a person will react after a certain amount of conditioning, which is not always the case. And that's why behavioral psychologists were somehow straggling the line of how scientific it really is, even though for some people it's beneficial in therapy. Okay.
Go ahead. Go ahead.
Sit here as a kid growing up.